CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, if you'd like to introduce our sponsors.
Absolutely. Today's show is brought to you by Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney as outstanding and excellent. Also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for a large IT infrastructure.
And this week's CFO Radio news comes from Digital Journal. Digital Journal this month stated, "Social media outlets such as Facebook and Twitter have made it into our daily lives, including during business hours. A new survey suggests that chief financial officers' greatest concern in this regard is employees wasting time using these networks while at work. There are both concerns and benefits when it comes to social media outlets in the workplace. In the survey, CFOs were asked, what is your greatest concern for your company regarding employees' use of the social media? Nearly half, or 47% of CFOs, are concerned that employees are wasting time during business by spending time on Facebook and Twitter. Meanwhile, 14% believe using social media allows employees to behave unprofessionally. However, as part of the survey, 12% of CFOs said they have no concerns whatsoever. Well, today, Jim Mauck joins us to discuss the role of the CFO. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you.
Well, Jim, you're the Chief Financial Officer at Miles Properties, Inc. Miles Properties is a national property manager and developer that manages and develops a portfolio of over 80 properties at its height, including apartments, condominiums, townhomes, and warehouses. Prior to your role at Miles Properties, you served as VP Finance for Pulte Homes. You've held various manager-level roles at US Airways and began your career with KPMG. You're a CPA and have a degree in accounting and a certificate of a double major in finance from Virginia Tech. So, Jim, tell us a little bit about your background, and let's start by lessons learned at US Airways. What did you learn during your time there?
Yeah, absolutely. US Airways, I think, is what I would say the place I kind of grew up, if you will. I think we all kind of grow up somewhere, sometime. And, you know, the years I spent with KPMG prior to U.S. Airways were a great foundation. But it's really at U.S. Airways, you know, I entered the company in a staff role and, you know, was exposed at initially just to kind of, all right, how does a real life accounting department work at a major company? And very quickly took on a manager role, and from there, you know, got to really see all facets of the company. Worked with, you know, financial planning, and the pensions and risk management group. The you know, of course, the accounting group, the treasury group. You know, my roles there touched all parts of the business, and got some, you know, pretty good exposure to folks early on, and really, you know, that's kind of where you could say I learned business, if you will.
You cut your teeth.
Exactly.
Now, at what stage of US Airways history? They've gone through a little bit of ups and downs themselves and some growth and some decline. At what stage of their life cycle were you there?
I started actually kind of when times were good. This would have been late 90s. Mid to late 90s, and kind of stayed with them through their first Chapter 11.
Always a problem when you talk about a company having their first Chapter 11.
Yes. Did not make it to Chapter 22. So, you know, there was definitely some lessons learned there just on, you know, the company itself and kind of what to look for when, you know, a company starts to go the wrong way, and, you know, how to plan for a Chapter 11, what steps are needed as you enter a Chapter 11, and then just the management process during a Chapter 11.
It's a significant change. We've had many guests on our show talk about change and change management. That of managing decline has its own set of problems.
It really does. You're first of all, you have an employee morale issue that you have to deal with. Right away, you need to keep
with not a lot of funds to be able to give them a bonus.
No, not a lot of funds. And you need to keep their attitudes strong because they're the ones who are out there, meeting with your clients, your customers, your tenants, whatever the case may be, whoever your client base is, they're the ones who have the direct contact with them. And it all starts there, making sure that they have the knowledge of why you're in the situation you're in, whether it's a Chapter 11 or a restructuring, whatever the case may be. Your employees really need to understand what's going on so that they can maintain a positive attitude and keep focus on what they need to keep focus on. And that'll spill over to the customers. I mean, the customers, clients can see it.
So would the CFO in your role in those earlier years and today, the CFO of a company that's going through these challenges, do you go meet with customers? When times are good, you should. So when times are bad, do you?
I think it depends on the company. I think it depends on how you define customers. In my role now with Miles Properties, Miles Properties and 12 of its affiliates, we're in Chapter 11 right now. And so our customer base would be our tenants who live at the apartments.
So that's an individual rather than a corporation.
That's
a little bit different.
That's a little bit different. And, but your day-to-day contact person, your property manager, is touching those folks daily. And they really need to understand what's going on and why. They're limited on the questions that they can answer, but you want to make sure at the same time they're sending a positive message.
So companies such as yourself, obviously the economic climate is such, unemployment is very, very high, and the statistics that come out each month and each quarter are still showing there's not a significant rise. In that regard, is it the economic challenge that your individual customer is having that's put you in this place?
That's a big piece of it. I mean, when with Miles Properties, you've got to look at the overall real estate market in connection with the economy. You have to look at the credit markets. The credit markets have really impacted the real estate markets. I think we're all aware of that. And it's a combination of things. So at the highest level, as far as kind of the transaction level, the buying and selling of real estate, that's dried up. And when that dries up, that hurts a lot of the liquidity that is put into the underlying assets, because a lot of that liquidity is put in up front. So that's a big piece of it. And then when you kind of look at more of a granular level and you're looking at your tenant base and kind of what's going on, I mean, certainly unemployment has impacted that drastically.
Are you finding any particular behaviors of your tenants right now?
That's an interesting question. We've seen a lot of doubling up, meaning tenants who, maybe they had their own places before, now they're living together.
So they room with the tenant beside and nobody tells the landlord?
Well,
maybe
that's kind of a that may have happened, but kind of just generally what you're seeing is folks who maybe lived with, had their own place before and now, or their families had their own place, to really take it to that extent.
Children
their families
have come home or something like that.
Yeah, and you may have two families living together.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the other big impact has been the shadow market of rental homes and condos that are out there, where folks can't sell their homes. And there's just a large supply there, and that's had a downward pressure on rents.
What's the typical build time for construction? Is it 3 years, 5 years, 10 years out?
That's going to depend quite a bit on the locale you're in and kind of what the entitlement process is. Each city, county, et cetera, they're going to have their own entitlement process. The actual construction phase, depending on the size of the complex you may build, you could get it up in a year. but it's kind of all the pre-development, the engineering, the entitlement. So, you know, you're probably looking at a three-year time span minimum.
So we may still now, perhaps just towards the end of the economic impact of that 2 and 3 year period.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, you still, to this day, you haven't seen very many multifamily starts. I mean, apartments just aren't being constructed. And so it'll be very interesting to see what happens, you know, in the next 2 to 3 years and kind of how the supply and the demand starts to shift and what impact that could have on rents.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about a lot of economic elements of the business. What I'd like to do, if that's okay with you, Jim, is to maybe skip back a little bit to you and your career. It's very good for us on the show to talk about why you're even in the role of the CFO and perhaps what led you to become who you are today. And you've had a perhaps slightly different path than many of our CFOs, not from the perspective of the roles that you've been at, but at the companies. So let's start at the beginning. You've served in, before you served in those roles, you double majored in both accounting and finance. At that stage of your career, that's an awful lot of numbers. Why did you choose that path? And do you have anyone who's potentially looking to start their career today and would like to be that CFO?
Good question. You know, I may be the odd bird in that when I entered college, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I knew probably early in high school I wanted to go into business. And I actually took an accounting class in high school and enjoyed it, knew it was a great foundation, but kind of realized it didn't give me everything I needed. And so that's what led to the accounting and finance double major. You know, it really hits everything from both sides. I think the advice that I would give anybody in starting their career is really just take whatever opportunities are out there for you to touch different functional areas that you may not touch. If you have an opportunity, you know, if you're someone that has an accounting degree and you're working for a corporation and you have an opportunity to work on a project with procurement, jump all over it. If you have an opportunity to work, you know, with treasury on a project, jump all over it, because in order to reach the higher levels of a company, you really need to develop that well-roundedness.
And would that extend to something like go spend a bit of time in marketing or human resources or legal or, I mean, maybe even as an intern?
No, I think it does. I think it's really whatever opportunity you can grab because you never know where it may lead. You know, at U.S. Airways, I had the opportunity to become the manager of pension and benefit accounting 3 years out of college. And, you know, talk about a dry subject.
5,500 homes, been there, done that.
But, you know, it was also the opportunity to say, well, hey, you know, I've got to grab this, and learned a lot of stuff that I would have never learned otherwise.
And you get to meet with different people in different departments.
That's the key. It's not only what you learn, but it's also who you're exposed to that you wouldn't normally be exposed to. And kind of sitting in on the development of, you know, an employee benefit plan. You know, what third year person out of college with an accounting degree is working on that? It's kind of taking those opportunities, and you never know where they may lead. But when you get the opportunity to kind of just expand your knowledge, you need to take it.
So be open. Be open.
Absolutely.
To what comes. Well, you've served in senior roles at a couple of large, in fact, two large public companies and one private company. Tell us about how leading a private company differs from the leadership roles as a CFO in public companies. What did you learn from your experiences with the public, and what did you apply in that private world, and vice versa?
I think that you know, when you're working at a public company, you're focused on so many different metrics, you know, from EPS to EBITDA to
Reg FD.
Reg FD, you know, different operational metrics. There's, you know, depending on who you're working with, who your audience is, you know, you're looking, you know, you have a lot more visibility into your comps and their metrics. At a private company, obviously you're still worried about the competition and some of those metrics, but at a private company, you generally have, you know, an owner or a small group of owners, and they're really worried about two things. They're worried about cash position, and they're worried about net income. Cash position is so key at a private company because, you know, either you have some sort of small credit facility, or, you know, if you're in need of cash, you're looking at your owners, and they do not want you to look at them for cash. That's clear. And, you know, net income obviously that's key to all the large companies as well and driving their EPS. But, you know, when you're at a small company, you know, that's really, your owners are looking at that as that's what's going in their pocket.
I once worked for an employer, in fact, owner, who said, I can't spend net income, bring it to cash.
That's true. That's a good point. That's the other side of it. You know, when you're working with that public company, you know, the gap net income is so key. When you're working with the private company, net income means something a little bit different. You know, they don't really care about depreciation too much.
Funny that. They care about buying the fixed asset because that's cash.
Yes.
Or some kind of loan capital financing. But depreciation's not on the radar.
No, except when you're looking at taxes. But from a book perspective, not on the radar at all. So that's one of the key differences. The second part, I think you asked me, what did I learn at these public companies that you can apply at a private company? And the answer is quite a lot. Obviously, the controls and the control environment and the processes at a lot of these large public companies, the two I worked for, you know, were very much fine-tuned and in place, and, you know, a lot of the best practices were out there in place. And it's at the smaller private companies, you know, while there are certainly controls in place and so forth, you know, there's only a focus on so many of them. And depending on how quickly that private company grows or shrinks, you need to adjust those controls and best practices to fit, you know, where that company has gone so quickly. Because, you know, let's face it, when a large multinational company, you know, grows 5 or 10%, it's not going to impact controls too much. When a small private company grows 10%, there's a big impact on the control environment, and you have to know kind of what's important to address and when.
A little bit like the Titanic with the rubber dinghy beside.
Yeah. That's a good.
The wave comes, the Titanic's, meh. Well, what does the policy manual say? And the rubber dinghy's bailing water.
Exactly.
Well, what are the key challenges in terms of facing the CFO of a small private company in today's world? My question was going to be, is it cash management? But is it perhaps cash or perhaps financing of cash or both?
I think it's both. I think it is the availability of cash. When you're looking at, clearly, you know, how do you finance an acquisition, or, you know, how do you renew a credit facility in today's market? That's clearly a challenge. You know, at a lot of these private companies, the banks or the lenders would be looking at the owner as some sort of guarantor, or the ownership group as some sort of guarantor. You know, then you're looking at an individual's net worth, and you know, how has that moved in today's market with the stock market and so forth? So that's a big piece of it. And then absolutely cash management. As I hit on a little bit earlier, with a smaller company, your cash resources are a little bit more limited in that you don't have as many levers to pull. You know,
maybe not so many bank relations and so forth, not so many customers that can help.
Not so many customers you can help, and not so many places where you can say, well, we can really cut, you know, from this department for the next 4 months and shift some funds over here, because you don't have that many departments. You don't have many places to cut and pull from. So that's a big piece of it as well. So the cash management aspect of that and the financing of it is definitely one of the large challenges.
Well, understanding that Miles Properties and many of your affiliates have filed voluntary petitions for relief under Chapter 11 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code, that occurred earlier this year. I understand that you've also worked with six additional entities that operated under Chapter 11, including the U.S. Airways. Describe some of the unique reporting requirements. We've talked a lot about cash, and I think I'm going to hear another message about cash. But what are those unique reporting requirements while you're under Chapter 11?
There's a number of them. To start with, there's something called a monthly operating report that you're required to file with the United States Trustee's Office. It's basically...
And that's whether you're private or public.
That is whether you are private or public.
So all of a sudden, a privately held company now actually has to file something, and is it a public document?
It is a public document.
That's a new world.
And it is cash-driven, and it is a new world. So it's a new world for the private company in that, hey, all of a sudden information is public.
You're sort of opening the kimono for the first time.
You really are. The interesting thing is it's a little bit easier for the private company to adjust to that because it is cash basis, and so much of the focus for the private company is typically cash basis. The larger companies, anytime you have to adapt to a new report that is kind of a standard report that you must adhere to this.
We're again at the Titanic, right?
You're at the Titanic trying to adjust things pretty quickly.
And how long do you have to file your first report?
It depends on the date that you file, but you typically file, at least in the Georgia district where we're at right now, you file 20 days after month end. So that gets into kind of part of the planning when you...
If you go public on the 30th or the 31st, you've not got a lot of time.
You don't have a lot of time at all. But then again, you're only reporting a day or two worth of activity. So there's a plus and a minus. But in order to get the information system set up behind it, you don't have much time.
So you're reporting from the point at which you go and declare the bankruptcy.
That is correct. That's one of the reports. There's also reports to your secured lenders, and these reports can vary depending on what you wind up agreeing to with your secured lender. They typically, because they have a security interest in some asset, in our case here, it's the actual underlying apartments. And so they drive what's called a cash collateral budget, which is approved by the secured lender, approved by the courts. And then depending on what agreement you've reached with that secured lender, you will report maybe weekly, maybe biweekly, maybe monthly, whatever parameters you set up on that report. And it can vary greatly. So that's also a challenge, and that's a very unique challenge depending on who your lender is and what they want to see.
So you may be a company that's used to monthly reporting, and now you have to potentially create new documents that are once a week, once every 2 weeks. Systems don't necessarily adapt to that. Are we now in Excel heaven?
You're
getting close?
No, you've hit the nail on the head with a small company like ours. I mean, it is Excel driven. I can recall back the days at U.S. Airways. Clearly that's not Excel driven. I had the privilege of having a neighboring office to the head of our financial information systems at U.S. Airways, and he, let's just say, he was burning the midnight oil quite a bit.
Goodness. So is there an opportunity out there? We are sponsored by SAP Business by Design. That is a company that not only is known for the large product, SAP, but many, many mid-size and small-size, and the Business by Design helps small companies. Is there a niche for a bankruptcy cash management system?
There could be. There really could be. you know, it's
bankruptcies are always still going to happen.
Bankruptcies,
right?
Are going to happen. It's kind of to think about it. I guess that would be an interesting capital investment to have to make, though. But you know, I think there certainly could be.
Well, I'm taking a somewhat off track. Chapter 11. Obviously, there are a lot of challenges, financial challenges. What are the unique operational challenges in terms of Chapter 11? You talked a little bit at the beginning of the show regarding morale, employee morale. I certainly know when I was part of the WorldCom turnaround team that maybe you have new people that are helping you turn the ship around. The Titanic didn't get there overnight, and it's not going to get out of there overnight. And a lot of people could have lost a lot of money if it's a publicly held company that's going through those challenges. If it's privately held, they may have stock options, bonuses have gone, pay rises typically have not occurred. That's the employee motivational side of it. But what other operational aspects do you have?
Well, the kind of tying into the cash collateral budget I was just speaking of, the absolute requirement that operations needs to adhere to a budget. And, you know, of course, operations is used to having a budget. But, you know, your senior operations folks generally, you know, in good times or even normal times, can pull a few different levers and, you know, borrow from one bucket to service another bucket, or know that if I'm going to spend this money, it's going to increase my bottom line, so I'm going to hit my department budget, whatever the case may be. Depending on your individual cash collateral budget, and there are a few of ours at certain entities where you are restricted in your actual line items on your budgets, and there's no levers to pull. I mean, you cannot go over on these certain line items without having lender consent. Which, if the lender happens to be a large bank, to the time you need to get that consent and to go through that process, you may have missed your window for your actual need by the time you get the approval. So juggling it really puts a even finer emphasis on cash management at the operational level and what those operational folks, you know, are going to spend money on.
So is there a role that the CFO needs to play initially in educating what does this mean?
There's a very large educational role there and helping people understand, you know, what you can spend, when you can spend it, what your parameters are, what are your absolute do not do's.
If in doubt, come ask us, and we'll tell you no.
That's a piece of it, that's absolutely right. You know, you really have
the answer's no. What's the question? I've been there. Yeah. I mean, sometimes that is the situation. Yeah,
sometimes it is, but you still want to try to provide insight as to why. And you know, one of the other challenges that goes kind of part and parcel with this is, you know, the day you file Chapter 11, you cannot pay anything, any invoices, any vendors, anything prior to the date you filed without court approval or some other sort of approval in certain circumstances. And it is managing those vendor relationships where these folks, you know, didn't get paid. And again, it's your folks out on the front line who are having to manage those relationships. So again, that kind of ties into what they can and can't spend, but it's also, you know, more of a relationship element there too, you know, because they've worked with these people day in, day out, and clearly have a personal relationship with them. And to look someone in the eye and say, you know, nothing I can do, I can't pay you, isn't a pleasant thing.
Mm. And is there a secondary element there in terms of any payments that have been made for a time period prior to, are they under scrutiny?
They are under scrutiny.
What's the time period? Is there a specific time period?
There's different time periods depending on the payments, but generally all things are subject to a 90-day look back, and then certain things even have a further look back. And they're what's called preference payments, and they will be looked at pretty closely.
So who comes in and looks at them? Is it your auditor?
Believe it or not, it's not an auditor. It is what's known as – it can vary. It could be a claims administrator who might be working on behalf of a plan administrator. It could be the unsecured creditors committee, perhaps their counsel may engage someone to look at that. It could just be a couple large creditors who kind of raising some eyebrows at something. It really depends, because all of that information is public. When you file a Chapter 11, there's also a lot of one-time schedules that get prepared up front. And so all that information is public, and it can be one of many groups who take a look at that.
Could it also be many of many groups? Could you have multiple parties asking for the same thing, maybe in a different way or a different twist? Or
it could be. It definitely could be. And we've seen where I've seen cases where certainly maybe an unsecured creditor, a secured creditor, and maybe even an interest holder all kind of have the same questions on certain things.
What's the best thing to do? Sit them all down and answer one time? You don't really want them to meet one another, right? That could be disastrous in itself.
Well, it's interesting because they probably, even though they're asking the same question, it may be a different answer because of their point of view.
Yeah,
they're asking the same question, but for a different reason.
And because they have from a different vantage point.
A different vantage point, and they have a different priority in the pecking order. As far as when you exit a Chapter 11, however that exit may be, either as a reorganization or a liquidation, typically there's some sort of amounts that are paid out on your what's called pre-petition or pre-filing date claims. And depending on your class, you may have a different payout. And so your unsecured creditors come below your secured creditors. And your secured creditors – so the answers to their questions may be completely different, and they are concerned about completely different issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's a case where you have to know who your audience is.
Mm-hmm. So the unique reporting requirements, and it sounds like an additional administration burden.
You've hit the nail on the head there. It is a very, very much an administrative process.
So you're in bad times. You haven't got a lot of cash. That's why you're going through this process, because things are not all sunny on the horizon. Now you've filed, you've made the petition in the court, and you're going through the court process. Now all of a sudden, do you need to go spend more money to get extra help? Or do you just keep your fingers crossed? And there's more workload, obviously.
There's more workload, and when I was at U.S. Airways, obviously such a large company, we engaged outside financial advisors, and they were in there by the hands full.
I mean, and are these legal people or financial people? People like yourself that have gone through it before?
They're both. Legal folks and financial folks. The financial folks, almost became regular employees for a short period of time because it's such a large place. Now, at a private company where I'm at, we have counsel and we have financial advisors, but so much of it is done in-house because you're operating, under a different paradigm.
And you as CFO are working on trying to make sure that you're not impacting the operations. Clearly, salespeople got to go out and still sell. Human resources people have still got to go out and do what they do. While they may not be recruiting, they may be on the flip side helping with other motivational aspects of human resource management. Marketing, I don't know, maybe the dollar's dried up, but there's still efforts that need to be done there. And yet you face the potential that some of your employees that are helping you through this may be the ones first to leave. The finance people often know the numbers before anyone else.
That's a great point. It really does. The finance people often do know the numbers before anybody else, but the finance folks when you're talking to your employees and explaining things, because they have that knowledge, and depending on what the plan is when you enter Chapter 11, you know, when you, and obviously you can only disclose so much to folks, but when you're walking the finance folks through what that plan is, you know, they kind of, because they're so familiar with the numbers and are looking at things from a different perspective, sometimes that's actually an easier sell.
Interesting. Now, you're going through this process. It's an administration and court procedure. Some of the companies that you've worked for have gone into the landfill. Some of the companies have done a turnaround. So talk to us about maybe some of the more positive aspects of coming through this.
I think if you come through successful, there was a portfolio of apartment properties that we worked with a couple years ago that recently went through a plan confirmation. That's the process of exiting bankruptcy, and was actually able to buy down their debt from the secured lender and then go out and refinance with somebody else. And you know, the debt position on this portfolio decreased from somewhere in the $60 million range to just less than $40 million. So it can be a great tool, you know, when done correctly, if you have the right equity sources.
So you come out, is there a procedure where, perhaps for the listeners, explain, is there now a stamp of approval that you now have a clean bill of health and you stop filing those monthly statements?
There is. Once you confirm and there's what's called the effective date, you come out and you're essentially a new company.
So now you're being back to private and not releasing financial information if you were private to start with.
No, that's exactly right. And when I mean new company, I mean new EIN number, everything. And you'd actually notice on public companies, if you were to look at some of their public filings, you would see kind of a split filing in their 10-Qs or 10-Ks, where they're reporting two different sets of numbers because it's the old company and the new company.
And you go through fresh start accounting for privately held as well as public?
You do.
It's kind of a form off.
But it's kind of a form off. It's kind of, you know, it depends on what for the private companies, you know, it depends on how strict you want to follow it. What do your loan covenants say, et cetera. But for the public companies, you clearly go through fresh start accounting, which is very close to acquisition accounting, but with some nuances.
Interestingly, that in the circles that I've lived, very similar to some of yours, although certainly not 18 bankruptcies, but there's a field of fresh start accounting expertise that is very specific, very unique, and it's highly specialized.
It really is. It's I believe the governing accounting is SOP 90-7, I think it is, and it is very specialized. There's a lot of things, like I said, that are very much like acquisition accounting, and then there are a lot of things that are very unique to bankruptcy accounting that you'll only see once.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Of course, you've seen them, what, 18 times?
I've seen them 18 times. And the funny story is
So the next company that takes you on, should they get worried?
I actually joke about that sometimes.
Well, that being said, clearly you've got a vast amount of experience in this area. What would be your number one lesson for a CFO that perhaps is facing these kind of challenges for the first time?
I think the biggest piece of advice I can give is to make sure you have a good team. Surround yourself with good professionals, meaning your counsel and your financial advisors. There's a lot of upfront planning that goes into this as far as, you know, if you're a multi-entity company like Miles Properties is, really, you know, one of the big decisions is identifying what needs to be filed and not. Then there's timing considerations as far as when is the right time to file, and there's so many different things that can drive that, one of which is just timing of cash outflows. There's a very brief period of time when you file where you don't have use of your cash at all because you have to have court approval. And that could be 2 days, 5 days, and then you get what's called your first day hearings, and you get approval to pay your payroll in normal course, to pay your insurance and so forth. But you don't want to find yourself in a situation where you file the day before you're supposed to pay payroll, and then you have to tell your employees, well, you need to wait 4 days, because that is immediately setting the wrong message. And that's just one example, but there are so many considerations like that that you really have to look at. When are your kind of must-haves as far as your payments and getting those out the door? And then there's also, you know, you want to look at your cash position and your cash cycle as far as, you know, you want to enter bankruptcy with as much cash as you can. And so combining all these elements, you know, from a cash perspective, and that's what bankruptcy is all about, cash, helps you determine, you know, when to file. And you're going to need the right experts to kind of help point you in the direction of, well, you need to look at these things, you need to look at these things, et cetera. That's the biggest piece of advice I can give.
So I think I may know the answer to this question. We're coming up to our last question of the radio show. We've got a tradition on the show to ask you your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
I'm actually going to throw you a curveball on this. My tip of the month, it's not even really anything we've touched on today, but it obviously gets you there, and that is cost management. When you're looking at cost management, spare no detail. In managing your expenses, diving down to even the smallest detail can save the company, you know, plenty of money. And I think you can always dive in to whatever you're looking at, a contract, a department, one part of your operations. And I think there's always additional cost savings there if you're diligent enough to dive in and look for it. And of course, that dovetails into being a successful company and not having to file any sort of Chapter 11 or go through restructuring.
So hopefully the next company is not going to go through any of these, right, Jim?
That is my plan.
Well, that is a great tip, and I'd like to thank you, Jim Mack, for being our guest today and sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to our contributors for the news article, Digital Journal. And thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about the company, go to www.delaneyllc.com. SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized companies. For more information on their products, go to www.sap.com. This and other thought leadership about today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or would like to be a guest on our show, please contact us via the web. You'll find a link on cforadio.com to give us your information. Thanks very much for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.